Welcome to Mountain Talk. For your WMMT, I'm Sylvia Ryerson. On tonight's show, we'll be talking about heirlooms. Apples and beans, that is. As we head into fall here in the mountains, apple season is upon us. First, we'll hear an interview I did with Tom Brown of Clemens, North Carolina, just a few weeks ago, when Brown visited us here in Letcher County to set up his booth at the Mountain Heritage Festival. Brown became interested in finding and saving heritage apples in 1999, and to date, he's discovered over 1,000 apple varieties. He joined us in the WMMT studio to share about his collection and passion for old apple varieties.
My name is Tom Brown, and I live at Clemens, North Carolina, and that's on Interstate 40, about 7 miles west of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I'm 72.
And where did you grow up, Tom?
I grew up in Idle County, and that's near the county seat there, Statesville.
And tell me about your apple operation. What is your booth here at the Mountain Heritage Festival?
Well, what I try to do is to find the rare old apples. These are apples that people knew about 100 years ago, and then try to get them back in circulation. I mean, if I find an old tree and the owner will allow me, I'll take cuttings for grafting, and then I'll graft a tree or two and then have one growing at my house, and then I can take cuttings off of those and you know, sell apple trees or give some back to the owners. Or I've donated heavily to preservation orchards, and I've shared cuttings with other people that are interested in old apples, you know, to anything to try to get them back in circulation so they don't become extinct.
And what is your collection right now? What have you found? Or for people that might have not have seen your booth at Mountain Heritage, what do you have here with you today?
Well, I have 72 apples. That occupies an 8-foot table. And I actually found slightly over 1,000 varieties of apples over about 17 years. And the ones I have from this area with me is, let's see, a Kodak apple and Ernest Blair Well apple, thin skin, Haynes Big Red, and two types of horse apples. There were many types of horse apples in this county and surrounding counties, and at least one more, I think.
And all of those apples they're heirlooms, is that right?
Yes, these are apples that dated back to 1930 or earlier.
Wow. And so for those of us that might not know a lot of the science behind it, what's the difference between your apples and the apples we find at the grocery store here?
Well, they were apples that the old ones typically happened by chance. Apples are cross-pollinated. So, you know, just like a human child, it would have genes from two parents, like human parents or apple parents. And then when an apple falls to the ground and a tree grows from seeds, it would be a new variety or you know, it could be close to one of the parents. And the so-called more modern ones, like the Honeycrisp, that was developed maybe 30 years ago at the University of Minnesota, I think. And it was done with a deliberate cross-breeding program, you know, where they, you know, deliberately took the pollen off one blossom and put it on another one and trying to achieve certain characteristics. And what they do on a lot of the commercial ones, they're trying to develop apples that color up beautifully before they're ripe, and that way they can pick them early and store them and ship them easily. But maybe they don't have the flavor, you know, of a tree-ripened apple, you know, fully tree-ripened apple.
So if all apples come from different apple lineages, what makes an heirloom special?
The heirlooms came from, you know, typically chance cross-pollination. And then the local people would see this tree and you know, say this is a real, has real desirable characteristics, and then they would start grafting it, you know, taking cuttings off of it so that they could have that same exact tree. In other words, the Kodak apple came from a little community named Kodak, and it was supposedly in the 20s, if I have the history correct, there was a severe flood in that area, and this apple tree grew from seed, and anyway, so people liked it and grafted off of it. So the tree that I got cuttings off of is probably a third generation tree.
Wow, wow. So what first got you into collecting these apple varieties?
Well, my wife and I love farmers markets. And like, for instance, when we went to Alaska, we were made sure we were in Fairbanks on Friday, because that's when the farmers market is. And when we went to New Mexico, we made sure we were in Las Cruces on Wednesday, because the farmers market's Wednesday and Saturday. And we would every Saturday go in Winston to the fairgrounds in Winston-Salem, where they had a nice farmer's market. And there was a man there that sold, had heritage apple trees, and he sold apple trees in later in the fall. But in the late summer and early fall, he had apples for sale there. And these had, you know, fascinating heritage apple names and taste and textures. And I discovered that he had found a couple of the varieties himself, and I asked if there were any lost varieties in my section of Forsyth County, and it turned out there was one called a Harper seedling. And anyway, so I started looking for it informally and wasn't having any success. So I approached the local newspaper, the Winston-Salem Journal, and they ran an article about my looking for the Harper seedling, and I got 12 or 14 either letters or telephone calls about it. And I later found at least six sites where Harper seedlings used to grow in the community, and I didn't immediately find it, and I approached, it was sold by a nursery in the 1800s, in the adjoining county, Yadkin County, and I approached a little newspaper there, and they ran an article, and I got two calls, I think, and still didn't find it. And it was sort of like casting the net one more time. And I'm from Iredell County in North Carolina, and I approached a local newspaper there, and they ran an article about my looking for old apples, and I found five old ones. One of them was a Mosey apple and a Red Pots apple and a Yellow Pots apple. And then someone said, there's a lot of old apples in Wilkes County, and why don't you go there and look for old apples? And it turned out that was the mother load of old apples. I have found maybe 300 varieties related to that county. If you'll go online to my website, which is www.applesearch.org, and look at my 2013 newsletter. It's about Wilkes County, and list all the apples I found there and another 100 that I haven't found. So,
wow, 300 varieties from one county in North Carolina.
Yes.
That's incredible. Wow. And so is your collection apples from all across the country, though, as well?
No, it's mainly from about six states, and nice. And the reason for that is, I know there's super modern social media, and you'd think you could find them that way, but unfortunately, at least for me, it doesn't work like that, because, for instance, when you do a Google search, you don't say, "Thank you, Google, what can I do for you?" And so many these people that contact me by the internet, it's sort of like when they get the information they need, you know, they say bye and that's it. So it's almost like there's probably eight apples, rare ones I've found due to internet contacts, but they don't ever end up sending me cuttings. So it's almost like you have to drive and show up at their house.
Right, right. And so that's, is that part of why you come to all these festivals all throughout the region?
Yeah, and I like to go to different festivals and different locations because there's different apples. And you would think, well, you're not very far from Jenkins. Jenkins ought to have the same apples, but that's not true, because it's like if you go 20 miles, it's like the apples are totally different, almost, at least the minor varieties. Because maybe, umpteen years ago, 20 miles is what you rode in a day on a horse, you know.
Wow. And so when you said in Wilkes County, you said that you had found 300 varieties, but there are still 100 more you hadn't found yet.
Yeah.
How do you find out which are the apples that you don't have in your collection?
Well, they're apples that people have mentioned and I hadn't found. And about half the ones I found, the owner knew the name. And from what I know in the old literature, the name seemed reasonable. But the other half, I had to identify it.
Wow. And so you were telling me earlier sort of how important you think it is to be doing this collecting right now. What's the sort of urgency to be finding out the names and collecting them at this in 2014 right now?
Well, apple trees are not long-lived. They hollow out and maybe they live 50 years. I mean, I've heard stories of apples trees living a little over 100 years, but that's not typical. And the people that know the names and can identify them are rapidly passing away. And so I might have an apple tree and there's nobody left to identify it. And this is happening very, very rapidly. I have a PowerPoint presentation and I'm showing people, and I have like six people that have prominently helped me and, you know, told about the apples that each person had. And then after I'd finished the PowerPoint, it dawned on me that all of these were, five of the six were deceased.
Wow.
And they are not even the ones that really knew. You know, I'm talking about 70 and 80 and 90-year-old people. But it was really their fathers and mothers and grandparents that really knew the old apples. So even the people that I'm talking to and passing away, they know just maybe a third of what their relatives knew. But
yeah,
there's something special about Letcher County. There's a lot more old apples and old apple knowledge here than in a typical area.
That's really neat to hear. What are some of the stories you've heard here in Letcher County about old apple varieties?
Well, let's see.
Or of varieties from right here?
Well, some of the, or I can just give you some names. There was a thin skin, that was a prominent apple, and there were all kinds of horse apples. That's the real name, but every single county had one or more horse apple varieties. It's typically a yellow, sour cooking apple that's ripe in August. I mean, that's a typical description. And there was, some others. There was a rock apple and a Ford apple and a stump apple and a summer sweet apple and a June pippin. And they were just a large number of old varieties here.
How important do you think, you know, it was in this country 40 or 50 years ago or 100 years ago? I mean, was this something that was more common knowledge people would know about, different apple varieties? Or was it, you know, families would try to have breed their own? Or what do you think it was like doing what you're doing now, you know, a long time ago?
Well, for instance, in Wilkes County, in talking to the older people, it seemed like every other household up and down the road, there was somebody that knew how to graft. And that's the key to keeping the old ones going, is somebody that, since the apple trees don't live a real long time, is somebody to keep regrafting them for the next generation.
And what does it mean to graft?
Well, what you do is, there's two forms of grafting. One that you do in the late winter and others early spring, where you take you really try to take the most recent year's growth and a portion that contains two or three buds, and then you, with a different cutting techniques, you join that on a rootstock. These are little apple trees that have been grown specially for grafting, or you can join it into an existing apple tree, and then the union will grow together, and then you will have an apple tree like that. And then the other method is bud grafting, and you do that in August or early September, where you take just an individual bud off of a tree, and then you put that on a branch or one of these rootstocks, and where you have to cut a little place to receive the bud, and then you wrap it up with special budding tape, and then maybe leave it maybe 28 days and take the tape off it. There's different methods of doing this. And then you'll have a bud that's firmly part of this rootstock or limb. And then before it buds out in the spring, you'll go in there and cut it off right after that, beyond that bud, and then it'll bud out, you know, grow out, and you'll have that variety.
Such a amazing knowledge that we really don't have a lot of people in my generation that know all that.
And one other thing about Wilkes County, the one reason why there were probably so many apple varieties there is because I've heard maybe three of the older people saying that their parents took pride in having apples different from their neighbors. So a lot of places you'll go, there'll maybe be old apples, but they'll be the more common varieties like Virginia Beauty and Wolf River. And then they'll be somewhat repetitive house to house. But in Wilkes County, I'd maybe go to one house and they would have five apple trees. They would all be old varieties and all different. You know, there wouldn't be any duplicates. And you go to the next house and they'll have four apple trees, and they'll all be different from each other, and they'll be different from the apples at that other house. So that's why there were so many varieties there.
Gosh, and then think about all the different varieties of apple pies that came.
Yeah.
How amazing. Wow.
Yes.
Well, what do you think, I mean, we are heading towards if a lot of people don't keep learning how to do that kind of grafting?
Well, in a lot of cases, the agricultural extension offices in different areas, they are conducting grafting classes. But it's still important to find these old varieties and get them back in circulation. I only wish if I'd done this, 50 years earlier, I would have maybe found 2,500 varieties rather than 1,000.
You've got a whole lot.
I know. It would have been so much easier, but it's...
I think a lot of people don't realize how much diversity there is. I mean, you know, we go to the grocery store and there's Granny Smith and there's a few other kinds, but it's amazing to know in your collection alone you have over 1,000.
Yes, and they have just, you know, wonderful, unique properties. One of the ones that my wife and I really like is one called a pumpkin sweet apple. It's a medium or medium-large size and pointed a little bit and totally covered with a rough russet and slightly sweet and ripe in August. And that's a wonderful apple.
That sounds delicious.
I know it is.
I love that name. So many of them have such interesting names.
Well, some of them are named for people. You know, there's like the Ernest Blair Well apple and a Jeff Cox apple. And I have one down there that's just a gorgeous red apple called a Betsy Deaton. And that was from Mitchell in Yancey Counties, North Carolina. And there's others that are named for locations or, you know, like the Kodak. It came from the Kodak community. And there are others named for nearby objects. There's one was called a foot log apple and a hollow log apple and a pine stump apple. You know, they grew near these objects. And the most unusual, and there was one called a bee bench apple. You know, you might have seen either cinder blocks or rocks and then a board on it and multiple beehives stacked on it. That's a bee bench. So,
no way. Wow.
But the most unusual name I encountered was called Bughorn. And I don't know if that was a rhinoceros beetle or what, but that was near Hampton, Tennessee. No, I'm Roan Mountain, Tennessee. That's right. But it was also mentioned in the old literature, so it wasn't just one tree that one person named.
Do these apples have, do they have scientific names also, or are these names the only names they're known by?
Well, some of them would, because, well like when I mentioned Virginia Beauty and Wolf River, they're both old heritage apples, but they never, you know, they're, you know, getting fairly scarce, but they never really got out of circulation. A lot of them I'm finding are, you know, they were totally got out of circulation.
Yeah. Wow.
And you can see this. I have old nursery catalogs from about, 15 states. And some of them go back to the early 1800s. And you could see how there was a great diversity of apple varieties offered. I mean, I've seen some of the old Virginia nurseries, they'd maybe even offer 200 varieties. And it gradually shrank down, and some of the later ones, you know, that was like 19 and 28 or the early 20s, they were maybe only offering 15 varieties.
There's a real history of apple orchards in this region of the country too, right? I mean, I know in eastern Kentucky and southwest Virginia, there used to be a lot more orchards than there are now. Do you think that's something that could happen again, being more orchards in this area?
I know more about North Carolina, about the orchards in North Carolina, like Wilkes County and Alexander County. Or North Carolina, years ago, they were maybe 22 million bushels of apples grown at the peak.
Wow.
And then, you know, gradually people started buying less apples and people started importing apples. And at one time they could at least sell their apples for apple juice. And then I think the Chinese planted millions of apple trees and took away the juice market. So,
yeah,
that's my understanding now.
Right. Yeah, I know here too, there used to be a lot more. In Southwest Virginia, I think there used to be a lot more orchards.
Yes.
Seems like it's something that if we were able to sort of have growers that really had a lot of diversity like you have, there's so many different kinds of products that you could, like, you know, different kinds of cider that would whatnot. I mean, it seems like there could be maybe a way to make a market for some of these varieties.
Well, I'm real big on apple cider and vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have arthritis in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mild discomfort all the time. And then when I would do the apple grafting, you know, that involves a lot of intense things, squeezing and cutting and with your hand, and my hand would really hurt. You know, I'd just be real glad when I, the apple grafting would finish so my hand could maybe hurt less. And I talked to my doctor, and she said, well, there wasn't anything that could be done about it, you know, to really cure it. And I was at the Rutledge Tomato Festival, a Granger County Tomato Festival in Rutledge, Tennessee. And there was a beekeeper there and said that I ought to try honey and vinegar. And so every day I would take a tablespoon of honey and a tablespoon of vinegar and put that in a cup of water and heat it just a little bit to get the honey in solution. And I overlooked the fact that she said do it twice today, so I've only done it once today. And after 2 months, the pain went away, and it's been gone for 2 years and 3 months. No pain in my hand.
Wow, that's amazing. Yes. So apples have all kinds of healing powers.
Since there was some gentleman here in the county telling me about an old doctor that took an apple slice and would rub it on a child's warts, and the warts would go away.
So, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What are some of your favorite apple recipes?
Well, I love to make apple pies. I use two different kinds of pie. I mean, two different kinds of apples, like half a real tart apple and one that's maybe slightly softer and not as tart, and maybe 5/8 of a cup of sugar and a teaspoon of cinnamon and 2 tablespoons of cornstarch, and then I dot that with butter, and
that's all it takes, right?
Yeah.
You got good apples to start with.
And one apple I have on display is called a custard apple. They used it to make open face apple pies.
Wow.
And one lady came by yesterday and told me something I'd never heard before. She was had related something that was in an old New England cookbook, and they call the pie, you know, where you have a top and bottom crust, and she talked about putting the pippins. I mean, some apples are called pippins. Putting the pippins in the coffin, the two crusts you call the coffin.
That's great. Well, you must have had, you've heard so many stories with people that you've met through this process. Do you have any favorites? I've read your newsletter. You have some wonderful stories families have passed down. Is there anything you could tell us here?
Well, some of the stories are, you know, things that happened to me when I was looking for old apples. I was in Alexander County. There was one lady had a green russet apple tree and also a rattle core. I mean, at a certain stage of ripeness, you could take the apples and shake them, and you could hear them rattle, the seeds rattle in there. But anyway, I had been to the house about twice, and I had noticed like an old, you know, full-length trailer over there, but it was like in real bad shape, and I never imagined anybody lived in there or saw any evidence. And this, the third time I went back there, it was in late July. And there was, at that time, there was a little chain link enclosure. You know, it was maybe 6 foot by 8 foot and had a little dog house and this wonderful, friendly black dog in there. And it was jumping up and acting so friendly, and nobody was home at that time. But it was a 95 degree day, and there was no water in its bowl. So I eventually found a container and put some water in its bowl. And I was just so impressed with that little dog. And I went back in January, and I was totally shocked. The little dog's spirits was way down, and it was just skin and bones. Mm-hmm. And then I realized somebody was living in that trailer. and I asked about the dog. And then I made up this story about I used to have a dog that looked just like that. Mm-hmm. And I asked if, you know, if I could buy the dog. And they charged me $50, and I bought the dog just to get it away from them. And when I got it home, my wife said, "That's a lucky dog." So we named her Lucky.
So, oh, wow. So you brought friends home from your adventures as well.
Yes.
That's great.
And then another story about half the apples I found I had to identify. And near Franklin, North Carolina, that's Macon County. Like if you go to driving west on Interstate 40 and get to Asheville and turn diagonally southwest and start driving for Georgia, Macon County is like the last county before you drive into Georgia. And two people had mentioned a Manson Beauty apple, and one person had described it as a gorgeous dark red apple with red streaks inside, but their tree was gone. And then about 3 years later, on top of a mountain there, I found an apple that fit the description. But unfortunately, the person that described it to me had passed away, so I didn't have anybody to confirm that that was the Manson Beauty. And then maybe 2 years later, I was driving hundreds of miles away, about 20 miles south of Roanoke, Virginia, on a rural road, and somebody had two big apple trees, and I stopped and asked, you know, what kind of apples were they? And the man said they were winesap apples. And I asked if he knew of any other old apples, and he said, "We used to have a Manson Beauty." And he described it, and it fit the description of the ones that I'd found. So I mailed him some of those apples, and he said, "Yes, that's the Manson Beauty." So that's how. And sometimes they're not that hard to find. You just need to get out and look. In other words, a friend of mine was having he and his wife had gotten married up in Alexander, Virginia, and they were, after the marriage, they were having a special party inviting all their friends over. So we had, my wife and I had all day to drive from Winston-Salem up to Alexander, Virginia. And, maybe it was, like a 6-hour drive, but we had, 10 or 11 hours to do it in. So the normal way would be to drive, the interstate down to Durham and then take Interstate 85 up towards Washington. But we decided to go through I said, "Let's see if we can find a rare apple variety while we're driving to Washington." And we started, stopped, and people knew about some old apples, but we finally, it's getting dark, and we stopped at this real old store, and this elderly lady was there, Mrs. Hoyle, and Edith Hoyle, and she had a cheese apple, an early June apple, and one more real rare apple variety. So we were able to find the apple driving to a wedding party
goodness.
In Washington, Alexander, Virginia.
It's like a treasure hunt.
Yeah, and then some, I'd gone to a festival at Ferrum College in Virginia, and several people had mentioned, the name escaped me just a minute. A red side apple. And they had mentioned that two places in the area, and they were like 15 miles apart. One of them was Burnt Chimney, and that was the northernmost one, and I was going to drive between the two and see if I could find a red side apple. And I started out, and the road I picked, I went a mile down the road, and there were this was a Saturday morning, three men under a tree in a yard, and I went out there and asked them, and they told me three places where that variety of apple was. So,
wow.
Some of them it's like, you know, real easy. You just need to get out there.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. When you find a new apple, what do you keep to add it to your collection? Do you keep a take a grafting, or do you take seeds, or do you just take a photo? I mean, how do you sort of document your collection?
Well, I try to take photos, but you can't do it from seeds because they're cross-pollinated. The seeds would be, it would have characteristics of that apple in the gene bank and then also characteristics of another apple. So unfortunately, it can't be done by seeds. You got to keep regrafting them.
So unless you kept regrafting all of your apples,
they'll go extinct. You know, but then, you know, if you can sell trees or get other people to have the same variety, that's another less. There's so many of the ones that I have that I only found one tree, and maybe even the original tree is now dead. So there's no variety out there.
Do you have an orchard yourself?
Yes.
How many varieties do you have in your orchard?
Maybe 600 or something like that.
No way.
But most of them, a lot of them are still in containers. When we bought our property, it was 10 acres, and my wife and I liked streams and hills and dense forest and swamps, and so that's what we bought. But that's not what you need for apple orchard. So it took us a long time to get the proper, you know, part of the property cleared so I could have an apple orchard.
Wow. It must be pretty full of trees,
yeah,
I bet.
Yes.
So what are your goals for your collection moving forward? Where are you hoping to... I saw you had some landmarks you're hoping to get to.
Well, I want to do a book about my apple search, you know, not just describe the apple, you know, tell what the search steps I went through to find each apple. And I only have one son, and he makes costumes and mascots down in Atlanta and does, you know, makeup for some of the smaller movies they have down there. So he's not going to come back, but, you know, get the business in good enough shape to where I can sell it and somebody will, you know, keep it going. And another thing I do is I sell the trees for less. A normal price is $20 for one of the apple trees, but I sell it for $15 if the customer will let me pick out half of the apple trees. And the reason for that is when the customer specifies the different varieties, usually they'll just ask for ones they know about. In other words, they'll, you know, never ask for a pumpkin sweet or a queen beauty or a stump apple. And you know, they're wonderful apples, and if I can pick out some, I can get more out in circulation. I'd like to eventually get, you know, five of each variety at known locations.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we don't know what we like until we've tried it.
Yes, and it's fun to...
Yeah. So, do you make cider, or do you make any other products from your apples at your orchard?
No, I don't.
If people listening to this wanted to learn more about your project, or maybe they even had a old variety they could tell you about, how should they get in touch with you to learn more?
Well, they could email me, or, you know, they can go to my website and get the email, or they could call me. That's also on my website, or my home phone is 336-766-5842.
And what is your website again?
It's www.applesearch, that's applesearch.org.
Great. And again, you're in Clemens, North Carolina, right?
Yes. But I, you know, visit this area, and I'm also do a lot of custom grafting. You know, people would have an old apple tree that they want to save, and I can graft it for them.
And if people are passing through, can people come visit your orchard?
Yes, but they'd need to call first to make sure I'm home.
Yes, great. Well, it's so good to have you here in Whitesburg at the Mountain Heritage Festival. We're so happy to have your booth and your collection here.
Well, thank you. It's probably at least my fifth year being here.
That's great. Well, we'll see you next year, I hope,
all right.
too.
All right.
And I'll keep my ear out for other Letcher County varieties.
Well, if people would call me, I mean, because the time is rapidly running out, and, you know, they need to, you know, not wait, or if they know some elderly person that has a lot of apple knowledge, that, you know, it'd be nice to talk to them soon, because they might not be around for long, and or maybe I won't either. So
they need to call Tom Brown.
Yes.
And get in touch.
Yes.
Yeah, well, great. Well, thanks so much for coming
right.
in and talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Again, that was an interview with Tom Brown of Clemens, North Carolina. You can find out more about Brown's work at his website at www.applesearch.org. Another renowned heirloom collector from here in Kentucky is Bill Best. Best founded the Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Project in Berea and has gained global recognition for his practice of saving heirloom beans. We'll end our show tonight with an excerpt from a talk Best gave at the inaugural gathering of the Appalachian Food Summit, which took place in Hindman, Kentucky in May of 2014.
The way I got started in this was 51 years ago. I was busy planting my first garden. My wife and I had accepted positions at Berea College in 1962. She was the dormitory director where we lived in the dorms. And I was a swim coach and director of student activities and a few other jobs that Berea was very informal at that time. They expected any of the staff to do anything, and we did. And but another couple got together with us, Ermgard and myself, and we said that we needed to buy a farm. So we started looking in the Berea Citizen to find farms for sale. We saw one in Jackson County, 354 acres. $10,000. So we bought 354 acres for $10,000 that had a really ancient garden plot on it. So we hired our little neighbor, 10 years old, barefoot, the typical mountain kid with his mule, and he plowed our ground and got it ready for us to plant. We had an excellent crop. Our oldest son was 6 months old at that time. Well, not even that old. 4 months old when our harvest started coming in, and we had him sitting there in his infant seat on the rim of a half bushel basket, and we were filling the other bushel baskets and half bushel baskets with potatoes and tomatoes and okra and, unfortunately, beans. And for the first time in my life, I had ordered seeds from a seed catalog. And I didn't have a clue that the beans would be as bad as they were, or as tough as they were. Some of you even know what kind of beans. They were fairly new bean at that time, a product of modern plant breeding, Blue Lakes. And so, in keeping with my tradition of letting the seeds fully fill out the hulls, what we in the mountains call full beans. I let them get full, only to realize that there was no way I could break them. These were no longer snap beans. They were tough as nails. I could very easily have let them dry a little bit and made sandals out of them. Anyhow, we were at home in Haywood County, North Carolina, the Upper Crabtree community, that Thanksgiving, and I complained bitterly to my mother about my tough beans. And she said, well, I can solve that problem. And so she went to her collection and gave me several varieties of her beans, which were just simply called old-fashioned beans at that time. I don't think they were actually started being called heirlooms until maybe in the 80s when Seed Savers Exchange came into being. But so I brought the old-fashioned beans back with me and started growing the beans that were edible. And in two or three summers, in fact, it was summer of 1973, more than two or three, I saw an article in the Lexington Herald-Leader about a farmer's market being organized in Lexington. Went over and joined. That was during my vacation at that time, and we always planted at least 10 times what we ever needed. So I thought I would go ahead and get rid of some of my surplus. And I discovered immediately that what I'm just going to go ahead and call heirloom beans. Heirloom beans were immensely popular at the Lexington Farmers Market, especially with the Eastern Kentucky migrants to Lexington. And not only did they buy every one I took every time, but they also started bringing me seeds from their family stashes. And I didn't, because I was not in the business of collecting heirloom seeds at that time, I just simply accepted them and traded with them, but didn't get information about the family connections like this fella had sent to me about his bean. So I just started growing their beans as well, calling them by their name. And the next year, it got bigger. In the meantime, I thought, after 11 years in the dormitory, we had moved out to a farm that we had bought a few miles out of Berea. And I saw I had a lot of good gardening neighbors out there, so I went around and visited some of them, and I said, how about getting with me and starting a farmer's market in Berea? Several of them showed interest, and we started a farmer's market in Berea. The same thing happened there. These heirloom beans were very popular, and several of them, I started trading seeds with my fellow seed savers.
And Maria, let me see if I can find some of them now. Barefoot.
Right underneath your chair, Bill.
Underneath your chair. Here we are. One of the beans that was very popular, it was grown by one of my neighbors. It's the goose bean, which is known throughout the southern Appalachians. When I first asked my mother, how did the goose bean get its name? She said, well, my great grandfather, was shot and killed a wild goose, and they were found in this crawl, and we've raised it since that time. I discovered that that same story had been told to thousands of other kids. But that is the goose bean that is known throughout the southern Appalachians, the one that is being passed around now. There are several others that are called goose beans in local areas. There is also a turkey crow bean. I don't think I have it with me right now, but the story is the same. And within a 100-mile radius of Cumberland Gap in Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky, that is one of the dominant beans. It's known almost everywhere and sold on the side of the road. But again, the story was the same with the Berea market. People just went crazy over these heirloom beans. The same thing is still true in Lexington, although I no longer sell heirloom beans at either the Berea market or the Lexington market. I was the youngest person in the Lexington market the first year, and now, 42 years later, I'm the oldest and still selling both places. I ran the Berea Market for 30 some years and turned it over to another fellow who now, and now it's, it has its own organization and may even be, Mike, is it not for profit now? Its own organization is cooperative, and one in Lexington is a cooperative too. But in Lexington, not only did the Eastern Kentucky and other West Virginia, North Carolina, Virginia migrants to Lexington start buying their seeds, but even the horses said started buying them as well. I mean, they became immensely popular. Then a young lady from a stewardess at the airport from South Carolina, I think, maybe Georgia, she bought some from me and took them home, carried them home with her on the plane, came back the next week, and she said, I don't know what I did wrong. She said, the beans had strings, these strings, and we couldn't eat them. And I showed her how to string beans, and she had forgotten how. She had known that one time, but she forgot it. And she said, oh, the hint of recognition immediately, and she bought more to take home and try them again. By the way, as an aside, that when the modern plant breeders in all their wisdom created a stringless bean, they actually didn't remove the string from the bean. They just spread it out throughout the hull. And that's why beans are so tough now. And that's why you have to eat them while they're young and tender. And the seed companies tell you that eat while young and tender. Do not let lumps appear in your beans. And one that's the seeds. And the protein, you know, in our wisdom, we have created a protein-free bean, just like we have created a lycopene and vitamin-free tomato. And we wonder why we have so many health problems. But I think modern plant breeding is responsible for a large portion of our health problems now, because we just don't have the nutrients in the food. For me, it's a crime against humanity to remove the protein from one of the dominant protein foods throughout the world. And one seed company even advertised its beans as being grass-like. I mean, you had to, while we were just like blades of grass when you picked them. And I made fun of that in an article that got published a couple of years later. And I said, why grow beans at all? Mow your lawn, put it in the pot. You can have grass-like grass. You don't even have the food with the bean vines. Needless to say, that was the last year they used that terminology to describe their beans. But even though their beans did remain grass-like. But anyhow, one thing led to another, and in 1988, Judy Sizemore, who was a freelance writer, among other things, in Jackson County, Kentucky, did an article about our operation for the rural Kentuckian, which is now Kentucky Living, as many of you know. And within 6 months, I had received 86 letters from six states, innumerable phone calls, and personal visits from people wanting to buy seeds or trade seeds. And so I started being more conscious of what I was doing at that time. That's, I guess, 25 years ago when I finally awakened to what was happening. And not too long after that, we got a lot of other articles in newspapers. Then, thanks to Ronnie, we won the Keeper of the Flame Award with the Southern Foodways Alliance in 2003, was that? I think it was, I don't remember when. And then a big, very big article in the Chicago Tribune. But the full centerfold of me in my overalls picking beans. And about six pages altogether. And then, I mean, suddenly all hell broke loose and we were on the map. And my son, who had completed his doctoral work in agricultural economics at the University of Kentucky, had worked 4 years on a temporary assignment at Berea College, and we saw so much potential in developing a seed organization that when his tenure at Berea finished up for 3 years, he took over an organization, not-for-profit organization that we created called Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Center, heirlooms.org. And we were got our website early enough to get the word heirlooms in that. I think we were immensely lucky to be able to do that. And he ran it for 3 years, then he went back to university teaching, and now he's at Tennessee Tech and growing acres and acres of seed beans for us for this. But I'm going to tell you the story of some of the seeds that I've brought with me and passed them around. I'll start out by passing these around. These are shuck beans.
You sure you're going to trust them?
Also called shucky beans.
You're going to trust them out here? You don't think somebody will steal them?
Also called shucky beans, also called leather britches, and in certain parts of the southern Kentucky and northeast Tennessee, called fodder beans. And this at one time was the dominant food source throughout the mountains. Now it's used mostly in on special occasions, weddings, anniversaries, Thanksgiving, especially Thanksgiving, Christmas. And I get orders from them all across the United States. They typically try to do close to 100 pounds just to illustrate to people what they are. I'm going to tell you the story of some of these beans. This is the Conover butter bean. William Henry Conover was a Kentucky soldier in the war between the states, and he was in New Orleans at the time that the war was over. And as he walked back to Kentucky, he liberated any number of butter beans on the way back. 10 varieties in all, and they have been grown by that Conover family. I was given that by my great grandson in Somerset for all of these years since the Civil War. You can look up William Henry Conover on the web, and he was quite an illustrious history, and these butter beans are not even mentioned. I mean, his soldiering were the ones mentioned. Some of you have heard of this little town called Hazard. This is the Hazard fall bean, which has become quite popular too. Now, probably I'm speaking to the choir here, but most of you know, most gardeners, traditional gardeners, have at least one fall bean, sometimes more than one, and they are grown to come in just before the first frost, preferably, and then they're eaten as shelly beans, shell fresh from the hulls. And I had a next door where we live now for the last 40 some years, and he would grow fall beans just to put in plastic bags in his freezer. But you can let them dry out and then eat them as dry beans. Of course, they have to be rehydrated to be as dry beans. This one is the non-tough back runner. That one came to me as a mutant a few years ago, a true breeding mutant. And this is by far our best-selling back runner, and probably 5 or 6 times more than any other seed that we sell. The Big John, which many of you have heard of, which is native to not Letcher and Perry County. The turkey crawl, which I mentioned earlier, which is especially prevalent in Harlan County and over into Tennessee and Virginia. I brought some more non-tough half runners, but the partridge head bean, or as it's commonly known as the partridge head bean, from Wayne County and Clinton County, Kentucky, and across the Tennessee state line. The Grandma Barnett bean, which is from Harlan County, which is a little bit, Floyd County, Floyd County. It's a little bit late, but nevertheless, one of our best Southern beans. The Doris Chambers Greasy Cut Short, which is from my home county in North Carolina, was given to me by one of my second cousins who is in her late 90s now, in fact. I've collected seeds from people. When I was writing my book, I started doing the grand tour of the Southern Appalachians, first interviewing people in their 90s or 100 or slightly over 100, and then I would move down to the 80s and then to the 70s. And the Roger Newsom fall bean, this is a beautiful fall bean from, I think not from this general area right here.
Again, that was Bill Best of the Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Project talking about heirloom bean saving in the mountains. To download or hear this show in full, you can visit our website at www.wmmt.org. And that's tonight's Mountain Talk. For WMMT, I'm Sylvia Ryerson, and thanks for listening.